Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Podcast episode. This is talking about Terra Nullius mostly and a little bit of Illuminae. So with me today are David.
Hi.
Tina.
Hello.
And our special guest this time is Jill, one of our Hilfskräfte.
Hello.
We've all read Terra Nullius at least, and we've all definitely read at least the excerpts of Illuminae. Jill and I have read the full text, and I want to start off with Terra Nullius. And the first thing I kind of want to talk about is, like, what are your initial thoughts, specifically about the kind of plot twist in the middle? So, David, why don't you start us off?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, and I keep thinking about why that happens, but when I started reading Terra Nullius, I had a very naive kind of approach. That is, reading the title Terra Nullius, you know, which rang, you know, so many bells in my post-colonial theory kind of head, I was expecting a piece of historical fiction, right? And I was reading this thing as a piece of historical fiction. I think we can talk about, you know, later in the podcast about how this can actually happen, because in so many ways this is a misleading text, and there is some great narratorial work being done, hints and stuff and things that you're being fed as you keep reading. It worked for me, and I was completely fooled by the set of narrative decisions and devices in play. So I was assuming that this was a piece of historical fiction right until the very middle, when that plot twist happens and we learn, okay, this is not a historical novel at all. Maybe it is, but then we'd have to redefine you know, the concept of a historical novel, but we're actually in a dystopian future setting and recolonization of Earth is happening. So I was like, okay, this is piece of sci-fi, science fiction, historical science fiction, bang, you know? I was fooled completely.
I think it's interesting that you just referred to it as possibly still being a historical novel, as in, you know, historical science fiction, or maybe narrating a future history, because I think you can support that through the text because of the little excerpts that precede every chapter that read like they are from basically a collection of sources on that time period. Mm-hmm. And they do make it seem like this, the events that we are reading happened in the past, and the quotes are either from that time when they talk about how horrible the natives are, or they're already looking back at the history of Jackie and talking about why that happened. So I think, you know, future history, that's a good point. Mm. If I can just continue on how I experienced
it. Go for it.
Cool. I knew it was science fiction, and I knew that there was a twist coming. So I approached it in a very different way. I agree that it read as historical science, historical fiction, but I already knew that it wasn't. So I was expecting a twist, but I didn't know exactly what the twist was. So what I kept thinking was, I wonder whether the natives are the aliens or the colonizers are, because that sort of kept me wondering, well, who are the humans here? Am I being cast in the bad role? Am I the villain here? While I'm clearly, you know, empathizing with Jackie, but is Jackie human? Is he not? I don't know. So that was what I felt while I was reading the novel up until the point where the twist happens. I did know it was going to happen. I did know roughly that it was going to be a humans versus alien situation. So different experience than you, David, and sort of, I don't know whether that made me react differently to the way the parallels between Aboriginal Australians and the human natives are made explicit in the novel. It might have made it seem more heavy-handed to me.
Okay, and Jill, what was your kind of take regarding this twist and how you read the novel?
Well, I think I really liked your genre you just made up, historical science fiction. I think that is such, because they're such opposites, I think that is That is a really good wording. I think that's funny. No, but yeah, I had a similar take on it, that I was really waiting for that twist, but then found out we were already in the middle of the sci-fi section happening. I was like waiting for something. I was like, okay, where does it come in? So yeah, I think that twist was actually done quite cleverly. Not everything in novel, I agree, but that was, I like that.
Okay, from now I'm going to speak to my perspective now, if that's okay. when I read the novel the first time, I like Tina, knew that it was science fiction. And I think that really informed how I read it. When I was reading the documents, I also noticed that the names were rather European sounding. And when I say European sounding, obviously there are certain semantic connotations there. But an example is, right, John Farmer, page 18, chapter 3. And certainly these kinds of names are also the names that the colonized push upon, or the colonizers push upon the colonized. I'm not saying that those are impossible names, but for me, they certainly resonated with a certain kind of white Western type of subjectivity that we're talking about.
But I think what you have to make clear here is that the European sounding names that are being used in these excerpts preceding every chapter, they're on those excerpts that are written from the point of view of the natives as they are constructed in the
novel. Yes.
And then we have colonial troopers as well. And some of them sound relatively human, I'd say. Or European as well, you know. But then we have people like Sister Bagra, the nun, who you could just about believe that to be a Western name, like Bagra. I don't know, maybe she's from, I don't know, a country where that could be.
I'm no linguist. I would say, you know, maybe some kind of Eastern European Hungarian, I don't know. But maybe, it certainly doesn't sound unbelievable either, right?
Yeah, but it just, it's not as clearly as it's, if it had been, you know, Captain Smith or Chuck
Johnson, right?
Exactly. So you can sort of become a little bit suspicious about who Sister Bagra is.
I think that is what novel does very nicely in a way, because it gives you all these things, and 90% of them seem to be, you know, hyper real in the sense that they could almost be identical reproduction of a colonial record if you go into the historiography and check out some of the stuff that was being written at the time, accounts, documents, all the records, basically. It could be that. It could be just that. It could be a very well-researched piece of historical fiction because of all these references that are very accurate. And then, as you just mentioned, Tina and Lucas, out of a sudden, there come these tiny little things, things that are out of the ordinary, things that seem kind of odd or off, but they are still not significant enough, almost, so as to be able to break your belief, right? So you're still upholding that make-believe, and maybe it is because you want to believe that this is a piece of historical fiction, and that certainly happened to me. Because of all these things that work so well, Jaramunga is a place in WA. References to colonial troopers, this interesting usage of terminology like natives and settlers and all these things, epigraphs that we get at the beginning of each chapter. So...
Before we move into, I think we're moving into our next topic really seamlessly here, which is kind of a discussion about how we feel that the novel handles its content and subject matter. But before we do, I do just want to kind of touch on something that we talked about. We talked about historical sci-fi already, and I would say this isn't a new genre. I would say to be a little bit wary of that, because we have a lot of time travel narratives that have already existed for, scores of years. And even if we look at Stephen King's work in 112362, I'm not very good at remembering titles. Or if we look at, for example, Harry Turtledove's alternate history work, all of which is very sci-fi driven, there's something to be said about this being a genre that's slipping under the radar, maybe?
But I think there's two different versions of this kind of historical science fiction. On one hand, we could have, you know, the historical novel, as perhaps Jill expected it to be, where something new then enters. I think a Suvin, a science fiction literary scholar, called this the novum, the new element of technology or, you know, future that enters into the text. And we could just as well have an alternate history, the term that Lucas just used, where it's very well set in the 18th, 19th century, and then the aliens come. That would have been a possibility, and that would be close to what Lucas just described as alternate history, right? But there's also this idea that it's future history, as in we're reading, the text is written from a perspective that is already after the events that are being described. So it's basically a historical fiction novel for the people who live at the same time as the excerpts are being collected as sources.
That is a traditional approach, though, right? If we look at War of the Worlds, it's told in the past tense. Mm. The beginning opens by talking about what happened, very Shakespearean in a way, by saying, oh, by the way, this is how it all ends. Right. And then we start. In a way, I do think there is certainly a parallel historical legacy going on here.
Yeah. I agree, but there's
although it is kind of
different
innovative.
Versions, sort of.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. Mm-hmm.
Lucas, because you brought up how we are also going to talk about how the novel handles its subject matter, and we just had this discussion about future history, and I was wondering if that isn't again a great aspect of Terra Nullius, because by virtue of writing a future history, it challenges the notion of post-colonialism or post-coloniality, because it kind of comes up with that scenario, or that question, rather, that scenario of what does colonization look like? What would it look like in the future if Earth were to be colonized again in the future? And it suggests to us that, well, there isn't really, or probably isn't going to be much of a difference to how colonialism went down in history and how it happened, right? So is a study of colonialism, a study of invasion, a study of imperialism, and setting this in a future history kind of framework, it really, in my view at least, it really challenges the notion of post-coloniality, because the difference or the borders, boundaries between colonial, post-colonial, again, re-colonial, neo-colonial are so fluid, are so fragile and so brittle. I think that is powerful politics in this piece of fiction.
I think that's an amazing point, because to be honest, one of the things that this novel argues, I think, rather well, is that when colonialism happens, it doesn't matter how enlightened the colonized are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's saying, look back at the colonized peoples. You don't remember, you don't know how enlightened they were. You erase that. And that's a very fair point, actually, that makes us have to reconsider our own history and reconsider that maybe the job of post-colonialism isn't just to make people feel like they understand colonialism and won't do colonialism, but maybe they also need to figure out a way to be colonized in a way that is will survive, right?
Interesting point. Yeah.
Because survival certainly is, a profound aspect that is being negotiated on the plot level. Certainly resistance towards bloody and violent battle, really. Fighting the invaders rather unsuccessfully, but yeah.
So reeling back in maybe, because I noticed we were kind of wandering off. Just a little bit. When we think about the subject matter and how it's handled, how do we think that it works? Tina, do you think it handles it well?
Well, I think in a way, up to a certain point, yes. And that is up to the point where it's sort of ambiguous, where we can we talked earlier on about these little elements where you already suspect something's not as it seems. I think there's also a couple of points where a technology is used. I don't know, it might be something fairly innocent, like a ballpoint pen, where you think, wait, that didn't exist back then, right? And to this point, I think it works well, it handles it well. And then there comes chapter 11 or 12, roughly in the middle. Let me just check for that.
I think it's both of the chapters, actually.
Yeah, I think you're right.
They have these little articles. Is that what you mean, where they are referring to what has happened?
Yeah, exactly. The first one is, made to be by Dr. Robert Black, leader of the native delegation to the settler parliament. And it talks about how Terra Nullius was a legal fiction, and then explicitly draws the comparison between the Terra Nullius in history in the colonization of Australia and the Terra Nullius in the current narrative that we are reading. And then I think chapter 12 is even more blatant, heavy-handed, as Lucas, I think, said at the beginning. On page 139, it says, "In interstellar terms, we, the people of Earth, are the Australian Aboriginals." And I personally, when I read that, couldn't help thinking, yeah, I got that point. Like, you didn't have to say it that way. And that's, I think, where it sort of breaks down a little bit, where it's kind of too on the nose.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, David?
I agree with what Tina just said, but since I vowed to defend Terra Nullius in public no matter what, I also think that this blatant approach, or this, you know, with the hammer on the head kind of approach to that message in the Australian context is still something that is very important and much needed, mm-hmm. and is going to be needed for many, many years to come, because what is, I mean, in the Australian post-colonial context and context of coming to terms with the colonial past and the colonial history, which in so many levels of public discourse in Australia is still something that is being pushed under the rug. Well, not exactly, but you know, there is that desire to think of 2008 parliamentary apology and then move on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of a post-colonial effective feel-good sort of desire that is you know, going on in many places, where people just think like, yeah, we have to move on, we have to keep going, and we have to look towards the future. And reconciliation, you know, however, is something that cannot truly happen if truth telling, and that's the term I'm after here, truth telling doesn't happen properly. And I think Terra Nullius has vowed in a way to be an element of truth telling, which is why is so direct and so explicit in many of the references that it produces and the trajectories it compares in a way. So I think it is a deliberate, I would at least read it as a deliberate narrative choice with a specific aim in mind. And I, that's what I value it for, personally.
What do you think, Jill?
Yeah,
or do you have something to say to that, Tina?
I was just going to say that I thought that it was a very interesting point of view, because I hadn't considered it that way. And thinking about it, how it's written to a certain audience, which is not necessarily me, who might need it being told that explicitly, that's an interesting way of thinking of it. So thank you for that.
And yeah, no worries.
And now I hand over to Jill.
No, I totally agree, because I also thought when reading it, I thought it could have done... when you have such a powerful narrative on hand, it could have been done a bit more gracefully in a way. Mm. And like, you know what I mean? Like literally graceful. There could have been put in like a bit more aspects, because I think way earlier, me and Lucas also already told about how there are a lot of repetitions just from phrases. That are repeated and details that are happening over and over, but that could also be the way that it was supposed to be, like that the author really wanted to like hammer it in, you know, in a way, to say it like over and over again, and to be that blunt, to not be very gracefully, but to be very true and blunt and in your face. So it could have been on purpose.
Mm. Mm.
David?
Yeah, just to get back to that, I think I'll largely repeat what I just said, but thank you very much, Jill, because you gave offered a couple of words here that I was thinking of but couldn't say properly. I totally agree from a stylistic perspective, right? Things might seem rather heavy-handed, and I as well was thinking, yeah, okay, I didn't get all these things. I'm sure, why is this happening? But where you might expect a bit more, you know, grace from a literal perspective, like a literary gracefulness, as you phrased it, Bernalius gives you the sledgehammer and then offers you the sledgehammer right in the face. I think Bernalius also makes that point that we cannot afford that political correctness or at political politeness, you know, in a sphere or a realm where violence of colonial history isn't properly acknowledged. And where the name of violence, you know, is rarely spelled out, which is why it does give you that sledgehammer kind of bang in your face perspective. Right. I'm going to tell you what happens. And it is not the first time that a novel ever did that. There are other writers who engage in that same kind of approach. And I just keep rambling on and repeating myself. That's what I want. Sorry.
that's great, David. I am actually coming with the sledgehammer myself now.
Please do.
I actually had the exact same metaphor in my head, so I really think we're on the same wavelength, even if we disagree on several things about the novel. So first I want to address, I think, what I would call heavy-handedness. I think part of that is intertextual. It's not really new. It's something that sci-fi has done since the beginning. Specifically, I would highlight the beginning of chapter 11. That's page 131, which Tina has already mentioned. So if you want, you can read that yourself. We don't have time for me to read it out loud right now. But I want to juxtapose that to the first chapter of War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, because he talks about the same thing. And we men, the creatures who inhabit this earth, must be to them at least as alien and lowly as the monkeys and lemurs are to us. We're going to go a little bit further. And before we judge them too harshly, we must remember what ruthless and utter destruction our own species has wrought, not only upon animals, such as the vanished bison and the dodo, but upon its inferior races. The Tasmanians, in spite of their human likeness, were entirely swept out of existence in a war of extermination waged by European immigrants in the space of 50 years. Are we such apostles of mercy as to complain if the Martians warred in the same spirit? So we already have these kind of comparisons specifically involving, Terra Nullius, specifically involving the Tasmanian situation. This is like a seminal sci-fi novel about invasion, right? And so this parallel is really obvious to me, and they even call it out specifically in the text at one point, mentioning, you know, hey, War of the Worlds. On page 177, which we don't actually have in the excerpt, so I'll read this tiny bit for you. In the ancient human novel, War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, an alien invader from the nearest planet invaded Earth. The human defenders were all but defeated when human diseases that humans had developed resistance to simply by surviving them eliminated the threat by infecting the invaders. The reality here is vastly different. And of course, the reality of colonialism was vastly different, right? That's the whole point of H.G. Wells's argument at the beginning of War of the Worlds. And so I think maybe the sledgehammer approach isn't as good as everybody thinks it might be. because if we're using a colonial approach to anti-colonial doctrine, maybe we're just inhabiting the same imperial system that produced this kind of oppression in the first place. Maybe not, but maybe truth-telling in this way is not the best way to do truth-telling, especially if we have an intertextual relationship to a colonizing imperial canon. I don't know. I'm a little bit on the fence about that.
Good point. I think I'll have to process that just for a second. It's a very good point, very challenging point, Lucas. Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Sledgehammer's been answering Sledgehammer. I'll just need a sec. No.
I think it would be maybe great material for a term paper. Just throwing that in there.
Definitely. I would love to read a term paper on this.
Yep. And the War of the Worlds is free on Kindle because it's a classic.
Yeah, it's old enough now. It's in the public domain.
Yeah.
I want to wrap up on our last thoughts because of time and switch to Illuminae.
Okay.
I think my overall thoughts are that the novel is successful, sort of, because I feel like it does address these issues and it could bring it to new audiences in an effective way, people who do not know about these things. But I sort of feel like the intended audience is probably sci-fi readers, unless the way it's marketed is different than I'm anticipating. I haven't looked into the marketing of this novel. It could be really interesting to check out whether it is marketed more as historical fiction or sci-fi. From my perspective, I knew it was sci-fi, so to me it was marketed that way. In which case, I'm a pretty regular sci-fi reader. I already kind of knew about this. This is a common kind of theme in sci-fi, even. What are your last thoughts, Tina?
Yeah, just to
you can respond to
react to that.
Before.
I think that's a very good point, how the novel is marketed, because that'll be something to think about, you know, any sort of novel that we read, because how it's marketed changes how we read it. Lucas and I read it immediately as a sci-fi novel, but I could well imagine this novel being marketed as, you know, sort of literary fiction, and literary fiction still to this day continues to be a little bit snobbish towards sci-fi. Yes, exactly. And so sometimes novels that are ostensibly sci-fi novels, we know it's sci-fi, everyone knows it's sci-fi, especially the author knows they've written sci-fi. And the literary establishment looks at it, sees that it has value, and immediately goes, well, it can't be sci-fi then, right? Even though it is. So, you know, that's how marketing can change both how you react to a novel, but also how you, you know, I don't know, address it academically, I suppose. Yeah, I think that works well as my final thoughts as well. So,
Jill or David, who wants to...
You want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I think... All right. I think, I don't know if it was the marketing intention of the novel, but I think for the author herself, it seemed to me through the very serious source of Instagram that she very much wanted it to speak for the Aboriginal community and for herself as an Aboriginal writer, because I think it was also her debut novel. And I think that was her point to, like, really, that was her, yeah, that's what she wanted it to stand for.
And this is an award winner.
Yeah, so that is just what I wanted to pay to draw your attention to. I'm not sure whether you can read this. It might be the other way around. But surely you have a version of the same thing somewhere or can find it online.
Sure.
What it says is here, it's winner of the 2016 Black and Right Indigenous Writing Fellowship, mm-hmm. and it's also shortlisted for Best Science Fiction Novel in the 2017 Aurealis Awards. So clearly it can be read through both angles. Mm-hmm. It can be read as, you know, Aboriginal writing, literary writing, and also science fiction writing. I don't think these two these three should be opposites as they are often perceived nowadays. Don't think they should be.
And let's pass the baton to David. So yeah. Your last thoughts, David, you can respond to me as well. I know that you've been gearing up.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm ready for that yet, because I will just conclude by ways of saying that I do concur with most of the things that were just being said, and that I certainly, but while I do concur, and I do understand these points, however, I will still say that I personally think that to me, Terra Nullius is an extremely successful novel because it does not shy away from blatancy. And I think that the blatant approach it has is something that is much needed in contemporary Australian debates about past and about history, that it thus offers an important fictional contribution to the overarching goal of truth telling, and I do stand by that. And I think it tells you the things in the face from a perspective where it says we cannot afford the metaphor, we cannot afford hiding behind words, because that is being done way too often, not only in literature but in politics and in the, you know, broader cultural discourse as well. So it doesn't shy away from explicitness and from, you know, being super, super direct. And from a stylistic point of view, yeah, that is certainly an arguable point. But it is so unequivocal in the message that it tries to hammer home and bring across. I appreciate that.
I agree. I think in the end that something we all can agree on is that this is WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. When you read Terra Nullius, you know what you're dealing with once you're done with it. You understand the ideas that were trying to be conveyed to you. I think it's time to segue to Illuminae if we can.
Just one last thing.
Okay.
May I? Because that's the conclusion that I've been looking for but couldn't find. I think, and maybe this is the sledgehammer getting back to Lucas. Maybe not. I just think that if it is heavy-handed, if you think it is repetitive, if you think, and not attacking, you know, any person in that particular space here, just the general reader as such, if you think that this is repetitive, if you think that this stuff, you've heard it before, let's move on, da-da-da-da-da. If you have all these complaints and bring all these criticisms to the novel, I think it is much more revealing of your personal attitude towards the anti-colonial scheme, you know? Maybe it is very telling about your specific subjectivity or positionality in that particular discourse. Because if you feel like, I can't hear it anymore, let's move on, maybe you haven't understood that much about the need to tell the truth. To make sure stuff like that never happens again.
I know you said you weren't attacking us, but I don't think that that's the kind of way that Lucas and I read it.
Of course not. Of course not. I know that.
I know. But just, you know, just to provide another counterpoint before we move on to Illuminae. I'm not saying that we've heard enough of this anti-colonial message. I think the anti-colonial message is brilliant. Mm. I thought it could have been more subtle. But then I do agree that when you spoke about how it needs to be more blatant in certain contexts, then yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we're all dealing in post-colonial studies. We're doing that for a living, literally. So, yeah.
I also worry that if we're not subtle, that maybe there's a bit of condescension there, right?
Mm.
We're repeating it again and again and again. Maybe that's an effective way of communicating, or maybe it's a condescending way of communicating.
I think it depends on the prior knowledge that you
have. Exactly. I think there's like a whole hierarchies there.
Absolutely. I was just attacking the bogan redneck literary critics, because there are a couple of them out there. So I was after those guys.
Okay.
In any event, we've gone over time because of our excitement. So let's move to Illuminae.
Let's do that.
The excerpts of Illuminae that we selected were not selected knowing that there would be a pandemic very soon. But, you know, now there is one, at least at the time of this recording. Maybe in the future we've solved this problem. Maybe it's still ongoing years from now. Who knows?
And we plan for this to be a course that runs again and again. So hopefully it'll also run in non-pandemic times.
Yeah, but at the launch of this, it's happening in the middle of the COVID-19 crisis. And I honestly think that this is extremely relevant, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
David, you look like you want to talk.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that we all have to help Astro Marine Tim win the fight against the space bugs by following these simple rules of hygiene, right?
Yes, that was what I was going to get at as well. On page 148, we've got this lovely little advertisement.
I love it.
I was just telling you, you know, always wear your face mask, always wash your hands, always seal doors and bulkheads behind you. Maybe not quite as relevant nowadays, but
close the doors. That works.
True. So yeah, it's a lot more relevant than I think any of us expected it to be.
I think the most important reason that we originally chose it is because of its multimodality, right? And when we say multimodality, that means uses a combination of different media, right? We've got our posters, we've got, not in the excerpts, but outside the excerpts, we have Wikipedia articles and stuff like that. In the excerpts, we have interviews, like written out descriptions of video cam footage and stuff like that. And these are all coming together, and we even see some censorship in some of the exchanges, because this is all a bunch of documents put together.
Which makes it, I think, such a, I mean, I was thinking of it as a blended kind of narrative, because you have all these different elements and different strategies and modes in there. And to me, reading the excerpts, it felt like a very interactive kind of text almost. I mean, reading is always, you know, an interactive kind of, well, literally engagement, but interactive in the sense of all these different modes interacting so well, as though you almost had a chance to intervene. Because you're being intervened with all the time, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That made it interesting and almost challenging to decode in one way or the other. At least to me, it was, yeah.
I mean, the characters seem to interact with texts that they have in front of them as well. there's this little comic on page 153, and it's clearly, well, I say clearly, it seems to be directed to the children on board of this spaceship, and it has, you know, it says Mizzy and Gizmo in How Does Space Travel Work? And it seems to be just this very innocent sort of, you know, comic, educational comic, and then someone scribbled over it, and I'm a good girl, and Daddy
that's,
said
that's I'm, the that's the disease, right?
Yeah, exactly. It really shows. It shows what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also it shows, in a way, right? This is a response to the comic, right? The comic is educating you to be a good boy or a good girl. It's educating you about how to live your life as a functional member of society. And mm-hmm. we see that once this disease sets in, this madness, right? And if you look at our zombie video, we talked about how, you know, the zombie figure is connected to all of these economic systems. So if we mm-hmm. have a comic that's educating you, a commercial media that's educating you to be a commercially effective member of society, and it breaks you, maybe you are just endlessly writing, I'm going to be a good girl, I'm going to be a good girl, because just like in that movie that's name I'm totally not remembering right now, you put on those sunglasses and maybe that's the real message that you see.
Mm. What sunglasses?
I will definitely look that up while someone else is talking.
Okay. Jill, I think you were the one who first suggested the novel for us, right?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
So do you want to talk a little bit about your discovery and why you suggested it? And then we all thought it was great because of the multimodality, as Lucas said, but, you know, just tell us a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Actually, when I had suggested the novel, I hadn't even read it myself, and I also didn't have it. Like, I couldn't look into it and thought, oh, that looks interesting. Mm-hmm. No, I had actually read a different novel of the co-author of Illuminae. So mm-hmm. it is Amy Kaufman, and co-authored with Jay Christoph, and I had read something from Jay Christoph that I really liked, and he also likes to use this multimodality thing. He likes to use footnotes and stuff like that. So I had heard a lot about Illuminae, and it was on my reading list. So when I had looked up the like summary or things that were happening in there, and we were looking for a sci-fi read, I thought this could be something, because it's new, it's modern, it uses all kinds of possibilities that are given, all kinds of different written possibilities of communication, mm-hmm. and I thought, yeah, that could be something, and it turned out to be something. So that's good.
Yeah, very true, very true.
It was very hyped as a young adult novel, and many people thought it was really an emotional roller coaster for them, but I think we here, or at least me and Lucas, have already agreed that this is actually the part that is not the interesting thing about this novel, because yes, of course, you can get very into the love relationship, of course, if you let yourself be taken into that, but I think we agreed that it is actually taking away a bit from the actual interestingness of the novel.
And this is something we've talked about in a variety of novels on and off this podcast, talking about how there's just these B romance plots, subplots that sometimes are just like, why is this in the story?
And I think sometimes it has to do with generic conventions, and it has to do with the fact that these books need to be sellable as well, and which is something that we as literary scholars sometimes, often maybe, just push to the side because we don't really want to talk about money and commercializing of literature, but you know that is how these authors make their living.
Absolutely, and I think this is how we make a living as well, because we, I mean, in most of all cases, we are consuming, analyzing, talking, writing about stuff that is in the market, right? Mm-hmm. Rarely ever do you find a person writing a PhD thesis or a bigger monograph, even a super interesting project, maybe to entertain, to look at literary underdogs or literary texts that are off the radar, off the mainstream publishing industry. But the marketability of, and the sellability of stuff is something that not only is important for the writers because they have to make a living, it also influences largely what and how is being analyzed and studied as literature in academia and in cultural criticism. So it's a filtering device, that marketability, isn't it? Because it filters it to us, and which is why I think it is very much a problem that as critics, we are being less and less skeptical and less and less aware, overtly aware of marketing strategies. We should talk about that stuff more.
And of course, with the young adult novel, quite often this B romance plot is expected. You hardly ever have asexual protagonists or just simply protagonists who, you know, realize that maybe the plague going on outside is a bit more important than do I go out with Peter or with whatever his other name is.
Yeah, totally.
Right. But that's the generic expectation. That's the expectation that these authors sort of have to make concessions to in order to be marketed, in order to be sold. And yeah, even if they want to be considered as literary writing and want to be studied at university, that's something they also have to take into consideration, because there's lots of self-publishing out there. There's lots of there's fan fiction, and I personally think that's a hugely interesting part of literature that absolutely deserves to be studied. Yeah. But I have the feeling if I went ahead and said, you know, I want to write my PhD thesis on Archive of Our Own and their Harry Potter fan fiction, not sure how well that would fly in most departments. So, yeah.
Good point. I definitely agree with that overall opinion of how there are so much marketing forces acting in the background and really determining a lot of what we read.
But the interesting thing that isn't it also an interesting thing to think about how Illuminate caters to all of these things in one way or the other? I mean, it gives you everything, you know. It's
it really it really is a grab bag.
Absolutely, it's almost a one size fits all kind of thing. It gives you. It gives you literariness, it gives you graphic elements, it gives you comic zines and all these different things. It can be marketed as a YA text. You don't have to, but you certainly can. So isn't that a thing, maybe, to look into how it seems to be very aware of these structural constraints to writing and publishing, how it seems to subvert them by deliberately giving you just everything and you choose, like, bang, it's there, right in your face.
And I mean, literally crossing out, censoring text, you know, showing us that there's editing in process. It really turns us back to the meta writing.
Yeah, I think in this respect,
more
it's
than
probably
regular metafiction.
Yeah, it's very intertextual, like very. I was also thinking, I think that is also in one of the excerpts, the doctor who is this writing his medical report, right? Dr. Salinger. I also thought if that was supposed to be some kind of telling name, but I didn't.
Like JD
Salinger? I can't see a connection there, right there, but
it's now possible. I really want to reread that, and but
yeah.
I mean, that's certainly what's happening here, right? There's so much like a multiplicity of intertextual and intratextual references that we have to deal with. And it really makes it, I think it makes it more complicated than it feels. And that's a really something that's strong about Illuminate, because it's able to how it causes certain things to happen.
Okay, Lucas?
Thank you.
All good. All good. Don't worry. Just come again. All good. And we leave this in there just for everybody to see how this is hard work, eh?
No.
It's all good.
One moment.
is Wi-Fi failure live on camera for all students to see.
I'm not even Wi-Fi'd though. It's like my whole router is just failing. All right. So I think it's back to normal.
Yeah, everybody there? You.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Hopefully. So what in the world was I saying?
Something about intertextuality, maybe, still?
Yeah, so the intertextuality and intratextuality together make this very complicated in a good way. It really helps articulate the points about the systems that they're focused on in the course of the broader novel, right? They're really engaged with ideas of how corporations compete against each other and how governments cannot or can intervene in these situations. And how sometimes it's up to individuals to do something to break or change that system. And that is a very complicated topic. So I think this intra and intertextual relationship multiplicity is really important for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they try to use almost everything that there is possible. I think later it is at least not for my eye, that wasn't as obvious in the excerpts that we had, but later there's also some Shakespeare coming up for those people who like those like classic references. There is everything in there.
Yeah, so it really takes the young adult reader seriously as well. Absolutely. By not refusing to deal with this intertextuality. It's very complicated and it's clearly saying you got this, right? Sometimes we have this attitude towards children's literature and young adult literature as lesser than, when that doesn't have to be the case and isn't the case with lots of examples, and Illuminae being one of them.
Yeah.
And because of time constraints and because of my internet failure that may continue to happen, I think it would be a good time to wrap up. We don't want this to be too long. We could talk about Illuminae for an hour.
Yes, right. We probably could.
But let's pass it around and give everybody a chance for their last thoughts.
Shall I start?
So who would like to start?
Tina's going to start.
Yeah. I thought it was a very interesting read. So far I've only read the excerpts because of time constraints, but I definitely want to read the whole thing because I think this experiment with multimodality is so interesting. We've got these comics in there, we've got the posters, and then we also have the scribbles and notes by the characters showing their mental their mental development, as in it, you know, goes bad because of the illness, and we also have a couple of pages where there's blood splattered all around. So I think it's really interesting how that works with a sort of almost tangible kind of intermodality. So, yeah, definitely an interesting text.
I completely concur. I completely agree with Tina. And also due to time constraints, I've been looking at the excerpts that most of you also did. And I immediately knew that this is something that I want to look into more. For basically the same reasons, I really want to focus more and offer more time, and keep more time towards trying to decode all these textual, visual, you know, multimodal narrative elements that are happening, that are going on there, because I think there is an awful lot to discover. I love it, and I certainly will once I get the time and grab a full copy of it and have fun with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so much that we could still talk about, like the treatment of refugees as well. That's all also in there. So yeah. A very full novel, basically. It's got lots to offer.
Yeah, I think also there could be like so many points of discussion that are covered by the novel. There's also this like philosophical question of the artificial intelligence and about agency, about mercy, as the spoiler, the artificial intelligence suddenly starts to develop a personality and goes crazy. So yeah, I think it can also offer a lot in that direction. So yeah, and it's also just a feast for the eyes. So just enjoyable really to see something different.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
Lucas, did you want to give your last thoughts?
I completely agree. I will give it a shot.
I can hear you.
Is it all still working?
We can hear you, but you were frozen. But
yeah. Oh yeah, your face. Yeah.
Oh no. Well, if my audio is working, maybe I'll stop the video.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Maybe this will help. All right, so I will wrap up with my thoughts here. I think Illuminae is something worth taking a deeper look at if you're interested in this kind of writing. I've given you excerpts that I think reflect the overall content of the novel pretty well. You get some of that B romance, you know, for better or worse. You get a lot of literary stuff mixed in here. You get cool multimodality. You get some awesome zombie action. That's what this book's about. Not really, but that's what this book is presenting, right? And you can explore that with a lot of depth. And I think this is an example of post-colonial science fiction that's working pretty well.
Mm. And it gives you useful advice as to how to deal with the entire COVID-19
Wash your hands.
Wear your face masks.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And help Astro Marine Tim with the fight against the terrestrial COVID bugs.
And I think that's probably a good point to end this podcast with.
It's a great point.
Sure.
Wash your hands, people.
Stay safe, and thanks for listening in, and we apologize for this weird Wi-Fi connection issue action,
which apparently isn't even due to Wi-Fi. But anyway, I think Lucas probably can't say bye at this point because of his internet issues, so we shall do that for him.
We do hope this was entertaining, including all
the mishaps,
the stumbling points. Exactly. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.